From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week, being indigenous in the Americas, we meet civilians fighting to take back their homeland in the Mexican state of Michoacán.
We're terrified, and we've been terrified for many years, and something has to happen.
And the sounds of a mother tongue in New York City.
Something make me to see better, you know.
All this and more as we look at the indigenous roots of Latino USA. That's coming up. I'm Maria Hinojosa. No se vayan.
De respuestas con el manojo lleno y las venas abiertas vengo como un libro abierto ansiosa de aprender la historia no contada de nuestros ancestros con el viento que dejaron los abuelos y que vive en cada pensamiento de esta amada tierra, tierra quien sabe cuidarlo es quien de verdad la quiera vengo para mirar de nuevo.
Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Part of the joy of making Latino USA is knowing that we get to cover Latino stories and issues we know are overlooked by the rest of the media. So when we were talking about this week's show, what it means to be indigenous now, we went to the source. We spoke to three Native Americans who currently live on reservations about what it means to be indigenous now. First up is Jossie Ross, who spoke to us from the studios of KUOW in Seattle.
I'm a member of the Blackfeet Nation, and I also come from the Suquamish Nation, right here outside of beautiful Seattle.
You grew up on the reservation?
I spent a good portion of my childhood and still live on the Suquamish Reservation.
And so when you look out from where you live onto your reservation, what do you see?
It's a beautiful place. It's always misty. We're right there over the water. My dad's a fisherman. My brother's a fisherman. Both my brother-in-laws are fishermen. And we've been living a very, very similar way of life for thousands of years. And my family proudly upholds that tradition.
And yet you left the res and went to Columbia University Law School in New York City because?
It was very important to me to get my legal education and hopefully get it in a place in a competitive atmosphere that would allow me to best be able to use that education to help my community. My Blackfoot name is Unagumsika, and that means little big man or young wise man. My community for a long time realized that I had this propensity for saying things and putting things into a context that other people could understand. And that's one of the reasons why people have invested in me. My community has invested in me. And when I say that, I mean that literally in regards to time, money, and resources and mentorship. People have brought me up to be a leader and to be a conduit of information for my community.
Most of the time, you know, outside of the reservation, we are told to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, that we have to do these things on our own. And yet you talk very lovingly about being a product of your community, a product of your nation.
Unfortunately, I think we see right now in 2014, the byproducts of this rampant individualism. You know, you see people that are seeking stimulation constantly, and we got to capture it on Instagram and on Facebook and on social media because there's no sense of belonging to a larger whole. I knew that whether or not I fell flat on my face in failure or was the biggest success in the world, I was going to come back home. I was going to end up in exactly the same spot. That was hugely important for me to know that sense of place and being from the time I was a little kid, where I belonged and what I was put here on the earth to do.
What do you think is being ignored about what needs to be talked about?
For the early part of my life on the Blackfeet Reservation, we have 75% unemployment. In any community, when you have 75% unemployment or anything close to that, if you have 20% unemployment within an urban area, there's other things that comes with that. There's a package that's waiting to be opened. And so you have things like social problems. You have drug use because people don't have constructive things to do with their time. You have social problems like abuse, which is compounded with things like Native tribes not being able to enforce criminal laws within our own territories and protect our citizens. We are still here, and that is not enough. it's important that we, in addition to still being here, that we be aware of who we are. Self-awareness is absolutely the most important thing for Native people, for Indigenous people within this country. It's not enough to just be biologically Indian. We got to live an Indian way of life.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Next is Lauren Chief Elk, who spoke to us from the Fort Belknap Reservation in Montana.
I'm Assiniboine and Nakota and Blackfeet. For the most part, I identify just as Nakota, but I get, you know, people ask what tribe are you from or what nation are you from. I personally, and I'm not speaking for anyone, don't feel that that's super offensive. It's not what are you. It's a little bit better than that when people ask how you identify.
Do you remember, Lauren, when was the first time that you realized, very specifically this word, that you were Indigenous?
I have grown up learning about myself, always knowing about my history, always knowing my tradition. There has not ever been a time in my life, whether I was in the city or on a reservation, where I didn't know who I was. I feel really lucky some days because a lot of people don't.
In the myriad number of problems and challenges that confront the First Nation people in our country, you are focusing around issues relating to violence against Indigenous women.
It's because of the history of this country and how this country was acquired to become the United States as a nation was through sexualized violence against the Indigenous people, particularly Indigenous women. I mean, it's a tool. Rape is a tool of colonization, which is still going on. It's not a history that, like, stopped and was a long time ago. This is something that happens that increases any time. You can see anywhere in the world, any time extractive industry happens, drilling, mining, the violence in the surrounding area happens. You can see this across Canada with the tar sands and the rates of violence that are around there and that they are against Indigenous women in very high numbers. We are resisting.
Thank you so much, Lauren. And finally, we spoke with Ruth Hopkins, who joined us from the Lake Traverse Reservation in South Dakota. When people ask you, you know, what is your tribe? What is your nation? Is that the right way for them to ask the question?
Sure, that's appropriate. Ask me what my tribe or nation is. Mine is the Sisseton-Wahpetonyate. That's where I'm from. We used to be called Sioux, but now we prefer to go by our Dakota name.
So you've been very outspoken on issues of cultural appropriation, and it's an issue that Latinos face a lot as well.
It's just gotten so flagrant in mainstream society. It's really an aspect of white privilege where they think they can take elements of other people's culture and do whatever they want with it. And it's about respect.
What goes on inside for you when you see that?
It's different being a Native American. You know, you might be into a certain artist and you like their music and you've been a fan for years. And then all of a sudden they release a video that has the lead singer running around in scantily clad outfit with a fake headdress on. And it just makes you feel bad. You know, it makes you feel like you're being mocked. And then because we know what that really means, we know what a war bonnet really means. And it's not about sexualizing our women, you know, and that's such a shame because our population among Native women, you know, 1 in 3 experience sexual violence in their life.
So when people hear this term cultural appropriation, they just might say, well, you know, come on, Ruth, stop being so sensitive. And you say,
I hear that a lot. I hear, get over it. It's not a big deal. There's more important things to worry about. But really, what's more important than identity? I mean, that's at the heart of everything. And, you know, there's 566 different tribes in the United States. And unfortunately, you know, when we see this appropriation going on, they like to go for the plains culture, you know, with the headdresses and the buckskin. And there's a lot of tribes, you know, of all variations that do not look like us. And, you know, it's not right to lump us all together in one category.
In Spanish, somos means we are. So can you finish that sentence for me? We are?
We are the future. We're ever present. We are our ancestors. Their blood flows through our veins, and we are their prayers come true.
Ruth Hopkins, thank you so much for being on Latino USA.
Thank you.
Ruth Hopkins is one of the founding writers for LastRealIndians.com. She joined us from South Dakota. Lauren Chiefelk is the co-founder of the Save Weob Project, and she joined us from Montana. Jossie Ross is an attorney and a writer. His new book, How to Say I Love You in Indian, is available now. He joined us from KUOW in Seattle. And this was just a snippet of our conversations. So to hear an extended cut of these interviews, visit our website, latinousa.org. Let's be honest, people. When you think about Latinos, you probably don't think of us as people indigenous to winter sports. The cold, the ice, the snow, the expensive gear. In fact, no Winter Olympic medals have ever been won by a tropical nation. That's why we were so excited to speak to Rico Roman. He's Latino, a veteran, and a U.S. Paralympic sled hockey player. He'll be competing in Sochi next month. We spoke to him from his home base in San Antonio. Welcome to Latino USA.
Thank you guys for having me.
So let's take it back a notch. You end up enlisting. In fact, you were just weeks away from ending your third tour, which could have been your last tour. And that's when you end up having a collision with an IED. You come back and you're having a really hard time with the injury, and you make a decision to amputate one of your legs so that you can be stronger. You talked about it with your wife and your family. What were those conversations like?
Oh, they were tough. I mean, very tough conversations. My leg was just so painful. I mean, I was so happy that they tried to save it, but at the same time, you know, taking the meds and feeling very loopy and not myself, or I was in a lot of pain and very cranky. So those talks with my wife were very difficult.
At what point do you just say, okay, I'm ready to go back to sports now?
As soon as they amputated my leg, I was right back into it. I never once, you know, looked at this as, hey, my life's over, or now that I do this amputation, I won't be able to do sports. I was more eager than ever to get back involved with sports.
All right. So you decide that you want to play sled hockey. Can you describe what it looks like?
Yes. You're in a sled. You sit kind of like with my leg out. You have like a bucket that you're sitting on, and you're balancing on two hockey blades. And to get around on the ice, you have two short hockey sticks with paddles on the top. And you have picks on the bottom of the shaft, and that's, you kind of do like a rowing motion across the ice, kind of like, it's like cross-country skiing, and then you shoot the puck.
Hockey can be dangerous because of the fights. What happens when you guys are playing sled hockey?
It's a lot of the same stuff that stand-up players do. The only difference is they don't allow us to fight, but it still happens. You know, guys will duke it out or get into a scuffle. My mom, you know, she was like, make sure you don't lose your teeth. That was her number one thing. She's like, you better not lose your teeth.
Rico, thank you so much. We're just so excited, and good luck, okay? No fights.
Thank you. I'll try not to, but no promises.
Rico Roman is a U.S. Paralympic sled hockey player and a U.S. Army veteran. He spoke to us from the studios of KSTX in San Antonio, Texas. Coming up on Latino USA...
I'd always assumed that our family had some Native American blood. How could we not, after so many centuries in the Southwest?
How a DNA test changed one family's origin story. No se vayan on Latino USA.
They're flying you back to the Mexico border to pay all your money to wait back again. My father's own father, he waded that river. They took all the money he made in his life. My brothers and sisters come working the fruit trees, and they rode the trucks till they took down and died. Goodbye to my one, goodbye, Rosalita. Adios, mi amigos, Jesus y Maria. You won't have a name when you ride the big airplane, and all they will call you will be deportees.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Indigenous America has always been held up as a kind of tourist attraction. 20 years ago, the indígenas of Chiapas said, no más, no more, and they took control of their modern destiny by staging the Zapatista Rebellion in a revolutionary act of self-determination. Last month, thousands of Zapatista supporters from all over the world traveled to Chiapas, Mexico, to celebrate the legacy of the Zapatistas and to learn about indigenous organizing and resistance from the EZLN. ¡Viva! Peter Brown, a retired elementary school teacher from San Diego, was at the anniversary celebrations for the group that took up arms 20 years ago.
Since that moment, they've dedicated themselves to a profound political movement of social change and of education, of consciousness raising, that now has transformed not just people here, but people around the world.
Brown says the Maya have changed the narrative of their lives.
The young indigenous people are now running everything in this caracol, but you don't see any arms. That's not what they're about anymore. Now they're really about raising consciousness and working with other people from all over the world to figure out, you know, what can we do to make this world a better place.
Camila and Diego Ibáñez are siblings who were born in Bolivia and are indigenous Aymaras. They travel by car from New York City to Chiapas to celebrate.
The past few years, I've been trying to connect more with my indigenous roots, something that I really realized while being with the Zapatistas, you know, walking through the milpa in the jungle, leading me through, like, the jungle. I realized that indigenous people hold knowledge and resistance in their bodies. So, yeah, being here for the 20th anniversary was super, super amazing, something I'll never forget.
But Camila and Diego didn't come to Chiapas just to celebrate. They also came to participate. They attended the Zapatistas' Escuelita, or little school. The Escuelita gave an open invitation to the world to study the Zapatistas' experiment in autonomy. And so the little school welcomed over 1,500 international activists and students.
You know, being part of the school, you know, my job was specifically to soak it all up, to learn as much as I could, ask questions, study, work, and then go back and, you know, talk to my compañeros and to the community in which I organize with, and let them know exactly, you know, what I learned and then how we can get closer to autonomía, which is what the goal is here.
The celebration continued at the Tianguis, which is the open-air market that has its roots in pre-Hispanic indigenous culture. The word itself comes from Nahuatl, the language of the Aztec Empire. But these markets are at the center of the Zapatista political and cultural exchanges, and they promote communal labor. The air in the market is filled with the Tzotzil language and the smell of elote, traditional corn on the cob. Francisco Romero is a young man from Oaxaca who came to Chiapas for the tianguis.
More than anything, we see the tianguis in the sense that it is an exchange that goes beyond just the economic and monetary. Here is where we rededicate ourselves to our activism and our political life in other places and organizations. This is how we are able to sustain ourselves politically. But at the same time, through the tianguis, we always try to create new and different social relationships.
There's no sign that the Zapatista way of living will be coming to an end anytime soon. So the question now is, can a small indigenous revolution in Mexico be a model for the rest of the world? Producer Tim Russo contributed to our report. You may have been hearing about stories from another region of Mexico called Michoacán, which in Nahuatl means the place of the fisherman. There are stories now from this region about another kind of armed uprising. Over the course of the last month, an extraordinary civilian defense force has been fighting, they say, to protect citizens from the cartels.
En su avance a otras comunidades de Michoacán, las autodefensas localizaron
The vigilantes are creating roadblocks on highways with guns in hand, refusing government orders to disarm.
El grupo de autodefensas surgido el 24 de febrero del 2013 en Buenavista y Tepalcatepec arrebató a los caballeros templarios.
Michoacán is a state in southwest Mexico. It's often referred to as Tierra Caliente, the hotlands, because of its blazing climate. It's a humble region of avocado and lime growers, and more recently, it's one of the most explosive regions for narco-related violence. Since 2011, the state has been terrorized by an upstart cartel known as the Caballeros Templarios, the Knights Templar. The group has been described as quasi-religious or even cult-like. In fact, you might say it's like something out of a comic book. Cartel members wear ceremonial helmets and swords modeled after those of medieval knights. The narcos in Michoacán also stand out for their brutality. The previous cartel, La Familia Michoacana, famously tossed 5 decapitated heads onto the dance floor of a local disco in 2006. Last year, the citizens of Michoacán decided they've had enough.
Y les pondré como ejemplo a todos estos poblados que ya no aguantaron más y en armas se levantaron.
A ragtag group of farmers and shopkeepers decided to rise up and create fuerzas autodefensas, self-defense militias, with the mission of combating organized crime in the state. In January, they went on the offensive, riding into cartel strongholds by the thousands, guns drawn, in caravans of pickup trucks and tractors. This corrido was written to commemorate their deeds. So, how do you speak to the leader of a self-defense militia in Mexico? Pick up the phone, of course.
Mi nombre es Estanislao Beltrán Torres, y soy del estado de Michoacán.
Estanislao Beltrán is a 55-year-old lime farmer and agronomist. He's short in stature and has a giant white beard that has earned him the nickname Papa Pitufo, or Papa Smurf. He even has the nickname engraved on his gun.
Basta ya de los criminales. Basta ya de que nos asesinen. Basta ya de que nos roben.
Enough, he told us. We've had enough of them killing and robbing us. The Templarios are big into meth production, and the region has the highest concentration of meth labs in Mexico. But Beltrán says it's actually not the drug trafficking that bothers him.
Se dedica precisamente a la extorsión, al secuestro.
Beltrán says the Templarios kidnap and extort ordinary working people and charge protection money from shop owners.
Y esa es la razón por la cual nosotros estamos ahorita luchando.
And that, he says, is why we're fighting. On January 13th, the autodefensas surrounded Apatzingán, a city of about 100,000 people, in preparation to invade. President Enrique Peña Nieto sent in the Mexican army to intervene and disarm the militias before the crisis could escalate further. But the autodefensas refused to give up their guns. On January 14th, members of the Mexican military fired on a group of unarmed civilians supporting the militias, and 4 people were reportedly killed. Since then, the army has backed off and decided to work with the militias, but things remain tense. Just last week, the militias signed a temporary agreement with the government that gives them status as an officially sanctioned security force. Estanislao Beltrán tries to make the case that the government needs them to fight the Templarios.
Nuestra gente nos dice en dónde están pasando las camionetas de gente armada de los criminales.
Beltrán says his people inform him about the movements of cartel members, intelligence that would be impossible for the feds to gather without them. The crisis in Michoacán is complicated, to say the least. To help us figure out exactly what's happening, we spoke with one of the brave Mexican journalists reporting this story from the front lines. Verónica Calderón has been covering the crisis in Michoacán for El País newspaper. She joins us from her offices in Mexico City. Welcome to Latino USA, Verónica.
¿Qué tal? Muchas gracias. Hi.
So, First of all, Veronica, what can you tell us? What do you know about the quote-unquote rebel leader, Papa Pitufo, who we've been speaking with?
Papa Pitufo, or Stanislao Beltrán, he has been a spokesperson for the movement. And he has been, well, really quite a character for me. To describe it to your audience would say, well, it's Mexican surrealism at its full. You have this guy who looks like Papa Pitufo, like Dada Smurf, and he goes around with a gun chasing these guys. It's quite crazy.
It does sound crazy. Now paint the picture of what it looks like when you get to this area.
The landscape, it's just beautiful, but there's such much terror in the population of the towns. For example, we enter with the car and there were only women outside the houses. And we felt we were being watched. A really not nice feeling.
So I've read that perhaps these militias might be receiving money from other cartels to fight these cartels so that they're not necessarily clean.
It's not clear. As when this movement started, many people in the Mexican government told me, and told a lot of journalists, that they thought that they were financed by Cartel Nueva Generación. But as I have seen in the ground, I wouldn't be so sure, because people are really pissed off. I would say there's a clear sense of anger in the population.
There was footage that came out recently of Templario leader Cevario Gomez, alias La Tuta, apparently walking freely around the town of Tumbiscatillo, Michoacán, and he was literally handing out money like a Robin Hood character. Let's listen to this.
Que somos un mal necesario y que desgraciadamente o afortunadamente estamos nosotros, pero que si no, estaría otro grupo.
So he tells the people that the Templarios are essentially a necessary evil, that if it wasn't them, somebody else would be there and that they're better than them. So is that true? If the Templarios left, would another drug cartel come in that could be just as bad or worse?
Well, they are convinced. They have this messianic complex, which is that they do feel like they're making justice in their own twisted way. They are so infiltrated, the government in these areas. So that's why he walks freely and, well, it's his town.
Wow. So this is, of course, the 20th anniversary of when the Zapatistas first arrived in Mexico, in Chiapas. When we asked Estanislao Beltrán if he saw any similarities between the autodefensas, the militias, and the Zapatistas, he immediately said no.
It's not the same movement, and it has really different backgrounds. There was a desire for the people to have their own system of government, which has happened in many municipios of Chiapas. And here we are in another kind of situation, because this has been basically a declaration of war against drug cartels. So there's not a lot of ideology here.
Veronica, you have been a reporter and you have seen quite a lot in your reporting. But did you ever imagine that you would find a time when you would have self-defense militias fighting openly in the streets of Michoacán, close to, you know, major cities against narcos? Did you ever imagine that you would see it come to this?
Mexico was, as you know, a really quiet country. And now that all that has happening, it breaks our hearts. But the thing that gives me hope about all that is happening, it's like for many years, it was like, no, it's okay. Oh, media exaggerates. I know people are finally saying, well, we're terrified. And we've been terrified for many years. And something has to happen. And I think that's, at least for me, it's hopeful.
Veronica Calderon, thank you so much for reporting on this story and for speaking with us on Latino USA.
Thanks a lot.
Veronica Calderon is a reporter for El País newspaper. Maybe you've heard people make the dubious claim that they're 1/16th Cherokee. Well, now science is helping to ground those claims in genetics. Here's writer April Salazar with her story about uncovering the truth behind her family's history.
What are you? That's a question I get a lot. I have black hair and freckles. The short answer is that I'm half Mexican. My dad was born in East LA. His mother's family was from Baja, California. His father's family was from a tiny town in northern New Mexico called Guadalupita. When I was growing up, my grandpa Bob would tell me about our family's Spanish history. He had grown up on a 100-acre farm in New Mexico that had come to the family via Spanish land grant. Grandpa told me we were descended from the conquistadores who had settled New Mexico in the 16th and 17th centuries. When I turned 16, Grandpa's brother presented me with a handwritten family tree. He said that the Spanish he had grown up speaking in New Mexico was closer to colonial Spanish than what was spoken in modern Latin America. He used verb tenses that were in common usage more than 400 years ago. From the family tree, I could see the names of my great-great-great-great-grandparents for the first time. There was a star next to the name of my great-great-great-grandmother, Maria Dolores Lopez, Navajo Indian. When I was in my 20s, my dad gave me a photo of Maria's daughter, Perfidia, and her husband, Casimero. Their shoulders are hunched, and they're posing with their daughter, Sarah. Sarah's hair is pulled back into two long braids, and she's wearing a thick beaded necklace. I was intrigued. I'd always assumed that our family had some Native American blood. How could we not, after so many centuries in the Southwest? And could the conquistador story be true? How much Spanish blood did we have? How much Native American? This year, my father decided to find out. He took a DNA test. The results were surprising. Dad isn't very Spanish, a mere 6%, but he is British and Cameroonian, and Irish and Italian, and even East Asian, and he's 1% Finnish. Finnish. But the biggest surprise was that Dad's really Native American, 47%. Dad shared the news with our family. My uncle, who would swear on Grandma's enchiladas that we are Spanish, chose to ignore the information. Dad's high school classmate said, "I always knew you were part European," which I think she meant as a compliment. When I shared the news with friends, more than a few suggested that I hit the jackpot. I'm really excited to learn about my family's Native American heritage, not because of imaginary casino riches, but because I now have a more complete picture of our ancestry. My family did such a good job of assimilating that we invented an alternative history. Now I can take all of those family stories and I can put them into context. And now I have a more nuanced answer to the question, what are you?
April Salazar is a writer and storyteller in New York City. And a quick note, mis queridos, if you listen to the music between our stories this week, you might recognize some of the songs. We wanted to pay respect to songwriter Pete Seeger, who died this past week at the age of 94. He was considered a member of the Nueva Canción movement in English. Rest in peace, Pete, and gracias for your music. Coming up on Latino USA, Indigenous Languages. The sounds of home in unexpected places. Stay with us. No se vayan.
There's a reason for me to be here. Dust is to dust, healthy memory. Even if they grind me, still dust I will be. This land is your land and my land. From California, then New York Island. This land my land from California.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. This is what it looks like in my house when we order a food delivery. The guy who brings the food is almost always Mexican. I take a minute to ask where he's from, and then I often ask this question. ¿Y qué otro idioma hablas? What other language do you speak? Aztec, Mayan, Arawakan, and hundreds of other languages are still spoken in communities across the Americas, and now increasingly in our towns and cities and suburbs, languages we don't get to hear all that often. So we decided to take a listen, a close listen, to just a few of those languages. Here's producer Michael Simon Johnson.
I'm riding in a taxi with Irwin Sanchez, who lives in New York, but was born in La Resurrección, a tiny town in the Mexican state of Puebla. He's reading me one of his poems.
Nehuatin, tlemomachti, kignawak, in atintli, noyolpatzmiki.
Irwin is speaking Nahuatl, an Aztec language spoken by over a million people in central Mexico. He says he decided to start writing and sometimes performing his poems in Nahuatl after his grandfather passed away.
His conversation, everything, it was Nahuatl. He speak only Nahuatl. So that's why I start thinking more and more in Nahuatl, like missing.
But not all speakers of endangered or vulnerable languages are making those same kinds of efforts. Alma Delia Garcia is a 21-year-old native speaker of Mixteco. It's a language spoken by about 300,000 people in central and southern Mexico. She says that, at least here in the U.S., Mixteco speakers try to hide their language. They speak mostly in Spanish, even in private.
Nos da vergüenza decir que hablamos otro lenguaje por miedo a la discriminación.
They're ashamed to speak another language for fear of discrimination, mostly from other Hispanics who only speak Spanish. But it's not just a fear of being ostracized that keeps Mixteco quiet. It's partially the language itself. Alma explained how to say I love you in Mixteco.
Cuni yo. Cuni es quiero. Y te quiero es yo. Es al revés.
But, she says, people don't say it that often.
Es más frío.
It's colder, emotionally. And more importantly,
en español es más fácil decir las cosas que en Mixteco.
It's just easier to say things in Spanish than it is in Mixteco. Alma believes this is because in Mixteco families, arranged marriages are common.
Porque, como le digo, ellos allá no llegan a ser novios.
You don't get to date first and see if you like each other.
No se llegan a conocer.
You don't get to know each other.
Son muy reservados.
And so the language of love becomes stunted. But compare that to, say, Garifuna, a language and culture from the Caribbean coasts of Belize, Guatemala, and Honduras.
Me and my brothers, you know, we would speak any of the three languages that come forth.
That's Hector Zapata, born in Honduras, but he came to the Bronx at a young age. The three languages he's talking about are Garifuna, Spanish, and English.
The elders mostly spoke to us in Garifuna, and that was just a simple way of keeping things going, keeping the culture vibrant, keeping us understanding who we are as a people, as a nation.
Unlike Mixteco, speakers of Garifuna are encouraged to speak it here. It's a symbol of pride. Hector's friend Pablo.
Pablo Blanco. I'm a member of the Garifuna Nation. I'm a DJ, promoter, Garifuna activist.
Played me a very upbeat Garifuna love song.
I know it's weird because most people, when they think about love songs, they're thinking about slow jams, you know, Luther Vandross. But we celebrate love.
As far as expressing yourself to the people close to you, Pablo says Garifuna doesn't mince words.
Uamatibunu means I like the way you are, so to speak. Most of the Garifuna language in itself, they're pretty direct words. They do not sugarcoat any of the words.
I'm going to give you my heart. Nichigalina nigibu. I'm going to give you my heart. Say it as often as you feel like saying it.
Depends how bad you want to get married.
What makes one group of people have more enthusiasm for their language than others? For Nahuatl speaker Irwin Sanchez, it's a way of reflecting on the people who once mattered to him.
Oh, so in Yowalehekatl, Okishtek, no, Shempashochitl. So what I say is the wind of the night took away my flower.
Language, after all, is just a window to culture. And I'm sure we can all understand that. For Latino USA, I'm Michael Simon Johnson.
From 1960 to 1996, thousands of indigenous Mayans were killed in Guatemala during a violent civil war. Since the war began, more than 400,000 Guatemalans have emigrated to the U.S. legally. Many have also come without papers, and some of them are Mayans who don't speak much Spanish, much less English. Ariana Brocious reports now on efforts to break through to one Mayan group in the heartland of America.
Three men and one woman lay sugar, sacred wood chips, alcohol, and incense in a metal basin to be burned as offerings to God. They're all wearing head wraps and traditional dress. The woman in a long, multicolored dress and lacy shawl, the men in embroidered black ponchos. They take turns praying aloud while they add colored candles to the fire. They speak mostly in Canjoval, one of Guatemala's 23 officially recognized Mayan languages. But this prayer ceremony isn't in Guatemala, it's in Omaha, Nebraska.
We're Americans, but also we are Mayans.
Los Angeles resident Juanatan Ocaño has been in the U.S. since 1988. He's in Omaha helping explain Mayan culture to guests at a weekend conference celebrating indigenous people.
The Mayan language is unique. It's our own. It's our first one. Speaking my own language, keeping the alive, it's another way to connect with myself, to connect with the world.
That language, Canjoval, is important in Omaha because about three-quarters of the 2,000 Mayans here speak it. Many are from the same part of Guatemala, drawn here by family connections and jobs. Flor Lorenzo Marcos came to Omaha in 2006 from Huehuetenango, a predominantly Mayan province in northwestern Guatemala that borders Mexico. At her kitchen sink, she washes corn husks to make tamales, or chuchitos, which she sells to others in the community. Despite her years in the States, including a few in Alabama, she doesn't speak English or even Spanish very well. In her native Canjoval, mixed with a little Spanish, she describes a time when that posed a problem.
Not long ago, I had an accident in Alabama.
An accident in which she lost most of the fingers on her right hand. She was chopping wood.
And when I was in the hospital, there wasn't anyone who could speak Canjoval nor Spanish, just English. So for me, it's much better to have someone who speaks my language, Canjoval.
She and the doctor were reduced to use hand gestures to communicate. Flor isn't alone. Many Mayan immigrants in Omaha only speak basic Spanish and little English. Mayan professor Daniel Caño says that, along with being in the country illegally, creates dual isolation.
And if we don't speak their language and they don't speak ours, the role of the interpreter is fundamental.
Caño is teaching special sessions on Mayan languages at a statewide conference on translation. These sessions are the work of the Omaha nonprofit Comunidad Maya Pishanishim, formed by Mayans in 2007. It's been training professional Canjoval translators for the past couple of years. Lucia Francisco, Flor's niece, is one of those interpreters in training. For the last year, Lucia and others have been providing Canjoval to Spanish interpretation to patients at an Omaha clinic.
This worries us. We want to help them somehow. That's why we're training ourselves, to help them so they feel at ease. Because if you don't speak the language here, or Spanish, it's a big need. Plus, for me, I like helping my people as I can.
The need for communication goes both ways. That's why Lucia is teaching Mayan children in the community written Canjoval. She wants them to easily navigate their new society, but also maintain their native heritage.
So they don't lose our culture, so they don't forget. We always want to keep our culture present, even though we're not in our country.
Lucia takes special pride in two students, her own children. She teaches them Canjoval so they can talk with older people, like their great-aunt Flor. For Latino USA, I'm Ariana Brocious in Omaha.
And now, queridos, a story, well, it's just one we couldn't resist. In the past week, it's been nearly impossible to avoid headlines about one particular immigrant, Justin Bieber. His recent arrest for drunk driving without a valid license has sparked Bieber fever. But this time, it's immigration advocates, not teeny boppers, who are making noise. Cristian Enriquez, contributor to Latino Rebels, told us about what's being called the Undeportable Campaign.
There's actually a petition for the White House to deport Bieber. There's a lot of undocumented immigrants in deportation proceedings that have done a lot less and have been deported, and Bieber pretty much gets bail. There was a campaign that was launched shortly after he was arrested, hashtag undeportable, and then it was basically a whole bunch of advocates for immigration putting blonde hair and green eyes on a selfie, asking for the same treatment as Justin Bieber is getting.
Every single person in the Latino USA newsroom had an opinion about whether Bieber should be deported, so here are some thoughts from our staff.
Can he be deported?
Should he be deported?
I printed out something from the Justice Department. This is what it says about grounds for deportation. The alien must be convicted of a crime involving moral turpitude committed within 5 years after the date of entry and sentenced to confinement or confined, therefore, for 1 year or longer. Administrative case law has characterized moral turpitude as a nebulous concept, these are in quotes, which refers generally to conduct that shocks the public conscience.
I mean, I'm shocked.
I mean, I think the moral turpitude thing if I do something awful, it affects my immediate circle of human beings, and which is not a very large circle. When Justin Bieber does something awful, everyone knows about it.
There's the argument that Justin Bieber's moral turpitude is moral turpitude that will infect the moral turpitude of everyone else in the world.
Yeah. You know?
A decision has not even been made yet, and already the double standard has come into play. The fact that he has not been immediately deported like so many others would have.
Right.
It's just...
And weirdly enough, he was able to get out of the country and go to Panama with his girlfriend.
Yeah, true.
He's documented, you know what I mean? Immigrant, right?
That is true.
But you can still, like, get your visa taken away from you, right?
It's true.
Actually, if you have a green card... Uh-huh. And you commit a crime probably similar to this with a green card, there are possibilities that you will be deported.
The question is, by saying deport Bieber, are we saying we should be imprisoning and deporting anyone who breaks the law in relatively minor crimes?
So then the thing to be asking for, or that the activists, instead of saying deport Bieber, should be saying free Bieber. Free Justin Bieber, free everyone, free every, etc. I mean...
There could be a positive side to all of this. That we came to this conclusion and that we're all looking sympathetically at him, I think, could indicate that others could too. I don't know.
It would be a great way to rehab his image.
I think it's possible, but I also think that he'd really need to... I guess I'm very jaded, you know, this whole, like, I learned my lesson, and... Well, all I'm trying to say is that the whole showman, you know, the whole, like, okay, mea culpa, I accept it, I'm better, I don't believe it. I guess, you know, I'm watching too much Scandal, so I don't believe it.
You don't believe it.
I don't believe it. So, Latino USA, what do you think? Should Bieber be deported? And if not... What's his proper retribution? Let us know your thoughts on Facebook or tweet us. We're at Latino USA. And from the foolish actions of Justin Bieber to the wise words of poets. In our latest installment of Sabiduría, the poetry edition, or Words of Wisdom from Poets, we're remembering the late poet Abraham Laviera. Or as we in New York City knew him, Tato Laviera. He was one of the greatest representatives of the New Yorican Poets Movement, and he passed away this past November. We gathered a few of his friends and admirers to speak about his life and legacy and to hear some of Tato's immortal words.
My name is Urayoan Noel. I am a poet and scholar. The New Yorican poetry movement is most often associated with the New Yorican Poets Cafe, but in reality, the New Yorican performance tradition goes further back into the 1960s and the Puerto Rican civil rights movement. Tato, before he was famous as a poet, he was a community worker and activist, and I think that strain is always present in his poetry. Commonwealth. No, not yet. No, not yet. I will not proclaim myself a total child of any land. I'm still in the Commonwealth stage of my life.
Wondering what to decide, what to conclude, what to declare myself. I'm still in the Commonwealth stage of my life, not knowing which ideology to select. I'm Jesus Papoleto Melendez, and I am Poet Laureate of El Barrio. You know, I really don't remember where I met Tato, or where or when, but it was way back at the beginning of the New Eurekan Poets Movement. Tato was part of a generation of poets where languages got mixed, English, Spanish, Spanglish, and that whole mixture of expression wasn't necessarily born, but was very potent in the language of the movement. And Tato's poetry personifies that quite vividly. Also, he was able to include the African element in the Puerto Rican culture in his work. Tato was, a great human being, a beautiful person. Everybody speaks highly of Tato all the time.
Hi, I'm Seri Colón, and I'm an actor, declamador. I read this poem twice. In 2011, I read it at the Potsdam Theater, and Tato was there, and he loved the way it was done. The name of the poem is Homenaje a Don Luis Pales Matos. Retumba! Retumba! Retumba el pasado, presente, prosa, poesía.
You can hear Urayuan, Papoleto, and Siri reading selections of Tato's poetry, as well as their own poetry inspired by Tato, on our website at latinousa.org.
Acentos a español, conspiración, engrasando ritmos pleneros a la lengua española para ponerle sabor. Pero, ¿qué retumba en la tumba resbalando?
And, mis queridos, that's it for this week of Latino USA. Our program is produced by A.C. Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Brenda Salinas, Jonathan Wolf, and Michael Jones. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Antonia Cerejido and Daniel Gunter. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, and I'll see you on Instagram. Hasta la próxima, gente.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Okay, Jossie,
little bid man.
Una cumsacam, yes. Ross. And then you can
close enough.
try this. Maria de Lourdes Hinojosa Ojeda.
Oh, gosh.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, offering a variety of sustainably harvested flooring, including pre-finished and stained, at 1-800-HARDWOOD. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. The Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems, at pewtrust.org. This is NPR.